during a strike at Bell Helicopter, allegedly ran into and hit a couple of the strikers. This whole case comes down to the sufficiency of the evidence, which I think is well enough reflected in a brief. Unless I get some questions on it, I'm going to concentrate on issue one, which is the sufficiency of the evidence to give us the constitutionally required notice of the actions upon which we're to defend, and the statement of Mr. Rather ambiguous statement of Mr. McNair after he was placed what we contend is in custody by being told he can't leave, and the officer taking off with his driver's license so she can assure him he doesn't leave. Mr. McNair, first on the indictment, we asked for the original indictment, said he intentionally or knowingly committed these offenses. And after several court settings, the state decided that maybe they do have a little bit of a problem, and they added recklessness to the allegation. At that time, we looked at the allegation of recklessness, decided it doesn't give us sufficient notice, doesn't even allege recklessness, and we filed a motion to quash. We went to the court overruled the motions to quash in each of the two cases because the language is pretty much the same. Now, if you read the allegations regarding recklessness, it equates to the same thing you see in every negligence case that's filed in a car wreck. You know, the defendant didn't control his vehicle in such a manner that he, you know, hit the other vehicle or whatever. It doesn't allege recklessness. It alleges mere negligence. And we were very concerned about that. We filed a motion to quash, which was overruled. And shortly after our briefs were filed, the Court of Appeals came out with the Rodriguez case, where they clarify exactly what has to be alleged when the state is going to try to use recklessness. You have to allege the facts that are necessary to constitute the negligence. In this case, it simply says that the defendant was reckless by failing to properly control his motor vehicle, commit assault on Jimmy Shook by driving his motor vehicle into or over John Byrd and caused bodily injury to Mr. John Byrd in one case, Mr. Shook in the other. Now, that's the same allegation that you'd use if you're trying to sue for negligence, and in fact was the same thing that they used in their negligence lawsuit against Mr. McNair. As we admitted, I don't think we actually admitted the allegation, but we brought up through the cross-examination of both Mr. Shook and Mr. McNair, Byrd, that they had alleged these same type of actions and alleged that the actions were not intentional or knowing, but were negligent. Therefore, the allegations contained here, as pointed out in the Rodriguez case, are not sufficient because under these allegations, his doing a legal act, negligent but still legal, not criminal, would be covered by the actions and allegations contained in that allegation of his alleged negligence. As the Court of Criminal Appeals pointed out, you have to be very specific when you're alleging negligence. Their examples were you could prove recklessness by shooting into the ground in a crowd of people. There's an act that clearly would be reckless. By shooting a gun in the air in a residential neighborhood, the bullet has to come down at some point and could come down and injure someone.
Mr. Burns, if yes. You're correct and the indictment is not specific enough, what about the harm analysis? Because wouldn't the evidence be sufficient to show knowing or intentional by the witnesses who testified that he gunned the car?
No, I believe that, it shows at most mere negligence, and that's the harm, because the jury, as the state argued, could have found simply that what Mr. McNair did in trying to get to work, he was simply trying to get through before they got in front of his vehicle again, as they do each one. And
but
which
I think the charge submitted, you know, do you count one, count two, and then just one blank for guilty or not guilty. So if the evidence were sufficient under either count one or count two, then wouldn't it be harmless?
Not if the allegations as they are there. Because you don't know if they found intentionally or knowingly, or you don't know if they found reckless. Now, if they found the recklessness, they could have read it as a normal person would read it and find that negligence alone was sufficient to convict this man of a criminal offense. And it's not. You have to have something more than mere negligence in order to constitute a criminal act. The allegation, which they...
If we don't know how the jury decided, then don't we have to defer to the? I mean, there's no way the jury wasn't polled. The jury wasn't, and if the evidence were sufficient to support intentional or knowing, then don't we have to go with that?
No, Your Honor. The allegation is exactly the the inference is exactly the opposite. If the jury could have convicted a man of something as for which he is innocent, and the evidence supports that claim, and it does in this case, even in the statement that Mr. McNair allegedly made shows, again, negligence, not criminal act. We don't allow a person to be convicted of a criminal act if the jury could have reasonably convicted him of a non-criminal act under the jury charges submitted to them, because we don't know which one they went on. They very well could have went on the negligence allegation that is laid out as recklessness in this case. And for that reason, Mr. McNair is entitled to a new trial based upon the failure to properly charge the jury to avoid the problem of them having convicted him of an act that was not criminal at all. And that's what they did, I submit to the court.
Did you object to the charge?
We did.
Okay. I figured and you did. It looked like you objected consistently.
To a lot.
Recklessness all the way through.
Yes, sure. I'm known as a very objectionable lawyer. And I was very adamant that that was going to allow him to be convicted of negligence. And as I say, the state even slipped into that negligence argument, and we cite that in our brief where he does make that argument. And would submit that the jury followed that and found him guilty. Because the jury, I believe as the note reflects, was split 6-6 at one point in time. And I submit that the argument that, if he was just merely negligence, that constitutes recklessness, was sufficient to turn the other six jurors to finding an innocent man guilty. Because he didn't commit a reckless act or a knowing or intentional act. He committed an act of negligence for which he was sued, and that's where it should be. Shouldn't be in a criminal court on the negligence action. The second thing, if I'd like to quickly address, is just the statement that was allegedly made by Mr. McNair. The police officer stopped him. No question, she stopped him. She came over. She got his driver's license, so he was not free to leave. She admits in the cross-examination, he was not free to leave. She would have stopped him had he tried. So he was under arrest under the statutory and constitutional allegations that he was not free to leave. He could not go. His movements were substantially restricted. And her holding,
he would have been committing an offense if he had left.
Yes, sir. Or shot.
He was driving without a license.
Yes, sir. And the second element, Your Honor, is the fact that again his statement was in direct response to an interrogation. It wasn't just something that he blurted out. as is normally the argument, well, you know, he didn't get his Miranda rights, and therefore we shouldn't use it because he didn't know anything he blurted out would be used against him. Instead, it was a direct interrogatory to him by the arresting officer in her investigation that prompted him to make a statement. The statement, the rather sort of ambiguous statement that he made, did you intentionally do this, or was it an accident? Yes, I was trying to get to work. I'm not sure what he, how that would be admissible at all. I mean, it's confusing, and it's not an admission. It's simply, a statement that he did something. He was either negligent or he did it intentionally. She didn't ever try to clarify. Well, was he saying, I did this negligently, which I submit to the court, the evidence shows happened, or did he do it intentionally? The evidence that Mr. McNair's vehicle was injured on the sides and scratches that would not be consistent with him hitting somebody in front. He didn't. Evidence, I believe, shows that they moved in on his vehicle, and one, I believe, is Mr. Shook, had his foot run over. But, you know, your foot doesn't get run over if you don't run up to the car. So, again, that's negligence. These things go to his detriment under the charge as submitted, and also the admission of the statement, custodial statement that he made to the officer. Again, those factors, I think, militate his having a new trial based upon the failure adequately to inform him of the charges against him, which is a constitutional right under American plant food, and therefore, you know, the higher standard of a have to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt before the court could affirm, because it's clear that it was error, and it was clear that it was a notice error, which is constitutional.
Of what import, if any, is it that the statement could be construed as ambiguous?
Your Honor, the only part about that is that it shouldn't have been admissible under any circumstances, but certainly not since it was obtained through custodial interrogation. She didn't give him the adequate or sufficient time or clarify the statement to see that if it was in fact an admission, as she was saying and as she testified to before the jury. Therefore, it is under Miranda a custodial statement that should not have been admitted for several reasons. But one, of course, is the fact he was never given his rights before he was interrogated under this custody. And unless there's other questions, I'll relinquish my other 30 seconds or whatever it is.
Yeah, I'll take up the 30 seconds.
Okay.
I didn't quite understand your answer. Was your answer really doesn't make any difference if it was ambiguous or not?
Yes, sir.
Here it is, where in evidence you could argue it wasn't an admission against evidence because he didn't admit anything because it's ambiguous. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying we made an argument to that effect, Your Honor, but it doesn't cure the harm is what I'm trying to point out, because right. The jury was told by the officer that it was an admission. The state argued to the jury that it was an admission. We didn't waive that argument by trying to counter that and sort of ameliorate it during our closing arguments as the state.
All right. I think I understand.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. I've pretty well set out what I have to say in the brief. I'm not going to add a lot to this. I can sit here and tell you, you know, I don't think he was in custody when he made this statement. Certainly,
talk about that.
Yes.
I mean, if he left, he's committing an offense by leaving.
But that's true in any traffic stop where you hand your driver's license over.
Okay.
The Supreme Court has said, though, in a traffic stop, that that's not a custody that equates to an arrest. When you're talking about the protections of Miranda, you're talking about the type of custody that's like an arrest, where your will may be overborne, where you need these protections of Miranda. This is a roadside stop for what the officer thought at the time was some kind of routine traffic altercation. She testified when she went over there, she was in such shock. She didn't have any intention of arresting because she couldn't believe somebody would have actually done that on purpose. He's on the side of the road. He's only left there so she can go call an ambulance, and then she's right back over there to deal with the situation, to do the temporary detention, the investigation. He's not under any kind of, he's not handcuffed. He's not even in the police car from what we can tell from the record. There's just nothing about it that makes it the kind of environment that's equated with an arrest. This was a temporary detention, and under the Berkemer case, Supreme Court has said in those, that's not what we're talking about, that you're talking about custody where you need a Miranda warning. I hope that answers your question.
Ms. Windsor.
Yes.
What Berkemer says is that the only relevant inquiry is how a reasonable man in the suspect's position would have understood the situation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's whether you understand that you're basically in a police-dominated atmosphere subject to arrest.
All right. In this circumstance, it's certainly not a traffic accident. This wasn't about traffic. This was about a witnessed act that the police officer saw of contact between an automobile testimony, two participants in a labor dispute walking the picket line. That's not a traffic accident, is it?
I think it is. I think it's just like if you're sitting at the stoplight.
The traffic was the people in the way on the picket line?
Well, I think you have, you know, when you have the picket line, the reason the police officer was there is because you've got some give and take and you've got to keep people under control. It's you know, the presence is supposed to kind of have people slow down, sort of take turns.
The officer was doing paperwork instead of doing that.
Unfortunately,
she just described.
Unfortunately, she was.
Well,
absolutely.
I guess the legal issue that we're facing under Berkemer test, Berkemer against McCarthy, is for an evaluation to be made as to the reasonableness of an interpretation mind of Mr. McNair that he was not free to leave. That had someone had taken his driver's license and told him to wait right here.
Which is the same kind of detention, though, as a temporary detention when you're pulled over for a traffic stop. It's got to be this kind of restriction that's equivalent to an arrest,
right.
Basically.
What
it's
kind
it's of got
traffic,
to be
what
to.
What kind of traffic stop is equivalent? There's not any speeding. There's not any failure to observe any kind of traffic signal device. We have a car that's being driven on an open roadway, except for the fact that there are people walking in front of the cars on the picket line. I just can't equate that to a traffic accident or a traffic matter.
Well, you still have somebody who's driving away. He's done something in traffic, which was hitting pedestrians. The officer stops him to investigate.
How did the officer catch him?
You know, I'm not sure if
she
I couldn't tell.
Down.
I think she ran him down. Yeah.
Her testimony in the record is that she saw what happened. She jumped out of her car and ran.
And ran.
There,
right.
Attracted Mr. McNair's attention and got him to stop.
Right.
So she was running him down the foot. So he couldn't have been driving away too rapidly.
He couldn't have been driving away. Yeah, I agree with that. Too rapidly. And he couldn't have gotten too far. But it's got to be the freedom of movement restrained to the degree associated with a formal arrest. there's nothing about this that's like a formal arrest. This is the police officer witnesses something. She's not sure what she's seen. She tells him to stop and wait here while I go call an ambulance. She's got his driver's license, so she knows who he is if he drives away, and hopefully so he won't drive away. It was certainly a detention. Like, if I'm pulled over on the side of the road for whatever reason, the officer usually, and I say this from personal experience, it's kind of sad, but he will take my license, and then he will go back to his police car with my driver's license, and he will call to see if I have any warrants, anything like that. That's the equivalent of what this is. She does take his driver's license, just as in a traffic stop, they take your driver's license.
Well, I guess it's in terms of the purpose of the Miranda warning and the Fifth Amendment rights and even 3822, it's certainly to have a person who is in custody understand any statements that they're made, that they make, could be used against them at a later time.
If it's to the degree associated with a formal arrest.
And in this instance, did this matter? How could it be anything but of utmost importance as to what was in the mind of Mr. McNair in whenever these events unfolded, which was the direct inquiry made by the police officer?
But the type of question you're asked isn't what determines whether it's custody or an arrest, because she, you know, if you pull someone over, have you been drinking? They can ask that, whether, and that doesn't mean that they've arrested you. There was a case, and I don't have it cited in my brief, I'll have to see if I can find it, but where police come on a scene, there's been some crime, I don't remember the exact facts of it, and they run after somebody, they chase them down, they catch them, they put them in the police car and handcuff them while they go run after the second person that they're trying to catch. And they said in that case, that wasn't, even handcuffing doesn't necessarily turn this into custody that's the same as an arrest such that would require Miranda warnings. So if handcuffing doesn't do it, then in this case where you're simply asked to wait while I go call an ambulance, but you're left by yourself, by your car, the side of the road, that's not going to be the type of restraint that's equivalent to a formal arrest that would necessitate Miranda warnings.
Are you telling us the handcuff case, they found no custody?
They found no custody.
That's the Court of Criminal Appeals?
I believe it is. I can't remember, and I'll go back and find. But I know there are cases where even handcuffing doesn't necessarily mean that you've been arrested.
Well, it wasn't necessary to handcuff Mr. McNair because he just took his driver's license and told him not to leave, and he didn't.
And he didn't. Just like when you're stopped for a traffic, though, they take your driver's license and ask you not to leave.
And I'm not ever going to agree on that.
And you don't. Yeah.
Thank you for answering the question.
I have a question about the first issue.
Sure.
Do you have any cases that are, it looks to me like the cases that talk about recklessness and alleging recklessness in an indictment, because here we just have, by failing to properly control his motor vehicle, and it looks to me like most of the cases dealing with recklessness are the type that Mr. Burns mentioned, where it says failing to properly control his motor vehicle in a crowd of striking pedestrians, or some type of further language than that. And I know that you cite the Crawford case, and I'm also wondering if that's distinguishable, because in that case, the indictment alleged reckless, knowing, and intentional all in one count.
And I think Crawford is distinguishable for that. I do cite it because I think that it kind of goes to my point on harm. I think it is distinguishable where we have it in a separate count, especially.
Okay, then my first question is, do we have any cases where something as general as by failing to properly control his motor vehicle?
I cite on, I guess, page 8 of my brief, and I don't remember much about this case, but from my parenthetical, Stewart from the Waco Court of Appeals, the language has failed to keep his vehicle under proper control. That was as close as I could really find on this.
Okay.
And I think, you know, these, I'll be honest, I don't like indictment questions, don't understand the law completely on it. It's just confusing. And reading these reckless cases, just they're hard to figure out exactly what the law is on this. I mean, it's a hard area. Here, though, we have failing to properly control the motor vehicle by driving it into or over and causing bodily injury. Now, I think if we just said he recklessly failed to properly control his motor vehicle, that's not going to be enough. But we have it combined with by driving his motor vehicle into or over them. If we just said he recklessly drove his motor vehicle into or over them, that's not enough. But we have that he did that while he was failing to properly control it. One thing I kept thinking about when I was writing this is just, well, how else in this case would you allege it? I can't come up with a better suggestion on this. Some cases. I think you start to get into such evidentiary matters. I mean, you know, that, and that's not what's required by the indictment. The indictment is just you have to allege something why he did was reckless. And I think we've done that here by failing to properly control his vehicle. Beyond that, I don't know that there's another satisfactory.
Okay, let's move to harm then. What about harm on that?
Well, I think on harm, you know, I don't understand how this would be harmful, because the way I read the case, and I disagree with Mr. Burns, I don't understand how, under any stretch of the imagination, the jury could have been confused and convicted him of negligence. That's not what was submitted.
The charge authorizes that.
The charge didn't authorize negligence.
If the indictment is not sufficiently specific, and so the charge tracking the indictment is not sufficiently specific, and the way the charge was submitted, it didn't have a count one, guilty, yes,
right,
no, count
right.
two. It just had all of them, guilty,
all of it
yes,
together,
no.
right.
Then the jury would have been authorized to convict him of recklessness assuming that's, it's not sufficiently alleged, which I'm not saying it is or isn't, but assuming that, then the charge would have authorized his conviction on a simple negligence.
I don't understand how it could have been a simple negligence, just because under the facts of the case and the way the jury was given the definition of recklessness over and over again.
What I'm really wanting to know is if that is what happened, is that harmless? Can that be harmless? Or if the charge authorizes his conviction on something that is simply negligence, is that harmful?
I think that, you know, under the facts of this case, it would have been harmless, because the issue, the two sides, I mean, it was if you believed his story and you believed his defense, you acquitted. If you believed the state's, which overwhelmingly with the evidence and the arguments, I thought, were that he did this on purpose. It was intentionally or knowingly. He was angry. He lost his temper. And if you do, then you convict him. So I think under the way this was presented to the jury, I think it's harmless in this case. And if the court doesn't have any other questions, I will ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Byrne, how do you deal with the question of harm on admitting the statement?
I'm sorry. What was the last statement? How do I deal with the question of harm?
Harm when you yourself have espoused that it's ambiguous.
On the statement?
Okay, how do you show harm when you're espousing that it's ambiguous?
Because when the state was arguing their case to the jury, it was argued as an admission. The officer was allowed over objection to argue to the jury that he was admitting to having intentionally done this act. That's what makes the harm. The fact that we tried to mitigate it and ameliorate the harm during closing argument obviously wasn't enough. The jury still considered it as some sort of an admission.
Was
so,
that an error in closing argument as opposed to harm from admitting the statement? basically the evidence said one thing and they're arguing another?
No, Your Honor, I believe that it's the fact that it does come as a result of custodial interrogation. It does come as a result of the officer's actions to obtain a quote admission, and her testimony was an admission. I think it goes back to Miranda, and the issue of custody under Miranda as opposed to the Fourth Amendment is much more lenient, if you will. Under Miranda, it's just that you're not free to leave, that you have a subjective objective person looking at this would believe that they were not free to leave. Therefore, you're under custody for Miranda purposes. There are some Fourth Amendment cases, Your Honor, where people were handcuffed while they conducted the search. Okay, yes.
Presuming
yes.
What you're pointing.
And I believe that the harm, again, is the fact that the state was allowed to argue it. The state was allowed to present evidence from the officer that it was an admission, that he intentionally did it. The harm was extreme. Our attempts to ameliorate it didn't waive that harm, and it didn't work either, because the state put before the jury that the officer's, quote, knowledge, training, experience, all this other stuff, that she believed that this was some sort of an admission that he intentionally did this act. And therefore, I submit to the court, when you put all that statement together, along with the charge, charging instrument, and the charge is given to the jury, that the jury might well have, and I submit to the court, did convict a man who was not guilty of the offense of aggravated assault recklessly. It was at most a negligence action. And for that reason, we believe that the harm is clear and strong, and that we're entitled to a reversal for both the first and second point, and that the evidence is, in fact, insufficient, and the court should reverse and order an acquittal. And unless there are other questions, I'm finished. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you very much for your arguments. Very well done. We appreciate it.